Team Time.
Welcome to Team Time Table Talks. I'm your host, Debbie Waith, and in this series, I'm going to be speaking with practitioners and experts about working with teams. I'll be discussing what working at the team level means from a practical perspective and how it's affected by increased uncertainty and remote working. My aim in this series is to optimise how we work, think and feel in teams to be more human, hopeful and helpful in our organisations. We'll hear my guests share their real-life experience and expertise in relation to working with teams and get past the soundbites to dig out the learnings and micro-tips that you can try with your teams today. We'll share stories from our practice to help bring our learnings to life, whilst of course respecting our clients' confidentiality. In this episode, I'm speaking with Trudy West, who's a Professor of Practice in Leadership and Psychology at Astridge Education, part of HALT International Business School. Trudy and I have worked together on large leadership development programmes, and she's a fantastic practitioner and researcher in leadership, who's got a real skill in sharing her experience and knowledge in a very human way. Trudy's work centres on helping people figure out who they are as leaders, through understanding themselves better, and in amongst others' expectations. She's done research into trust and hypocrisy, so there's no hiding when you work with Trudy. She believes in giving people autonomy to thrive and in developing their capacity to trust the values within themselves. Given this exceptional year, Trudy and I explore the changes and possibilities in the new ways of leading and teaming, and the importance to many of what Trudy explains as the transitional other, or the gap between work and home, whether that's the drive home or just the change in physical environment. How we think is different in that space, and it contributes to our wellness, how we experience others, and of course, the opportunity for those spontaneous moments. As Trudy describes it, if this is our reckoning with regards to work, what do we want to be left with? As we move from surviving to thriving, what do we let go of? What do we hold on to? Because now we've got some data available of what it means to work in different ways. What presumptions do we make? Whether about decision-making and who's privileged or excluded by some of those implicit presumptions? And how does this shift as our working practices shift? Does who's in the room still make a difference? We talked about what it means to be in a team today, and Trudy shared her view that it pivots around the task and the relationship. She stressed the importance of a relational space, which should be regarded as work, and not just nice to have or the soft stuff. A need, really, for us to shift beyond apologising that we're human and that we just need that relational space. So if humanity is the mortar to our teams and our organisations, how strong is yours? This past year has given us all an opportunity to remind ourselves or reconnect with what's important and sometimes missing, if we're honest, about the clarity of our purpose, meaning and belonging. Many of us have learned it doesn't serve us well to separate these from our work, as this separates us in our essential humanness. Trudy also shared her model from research on teams involved in the Clipper Around the World sailing race, which pointed to three key aspects for high-performing teams. How will your team measure against these? We also touched on the role of the skipper in this model, which centred around his or her need for sleep, something I think we can all relate to. I hope you enjoy this exploration of leadership and teams for our current times as much as I did. Trudy's always a pleasure to speak with and to learn from. Perhaps as you listen to the episode, you can ask yourself, what have you learnt of yourself over this past year? And what could you experiment with? How are your relationships? And where might you need to spend time renewing or repairing? And finally, how can you recreate the transitional space for a different quality of thinking in your new ways of working? So, Trudy, welcome to Team Time.
Thank you for having me.
It's super, honestly, to have you here today. We know each other through working as faculty at Ashridge Education, which is part of Halt International Business School. And we've worked together on particularly leadership development. And I know you've worked in a number of sectors and have such a great variety of experience, as well as doing research with teams and on trust. It'd be great to hear a little bit about, you know, who are you in this space? Who are you working with leaders and with teams?
Lovely, thank you. So most of my work at its core is helping leaders work out who are they? Like, who are they in all of this, in this complex space? You know, they're trying to lead teams, they're trying to lead themselves, they're trying to be good citizens in the organisations they work in, make a difference. But often they're also parents or children of elderly parents. You know, they have a life outside of this leadership space. So yeah. How do they bring the best of themselves? And often that's through understanding themselves in their full range of them. So a lot of the work I do is experiential and pragmatic. So there is academia kind of sitting behind it, you know, there's theory and frameworks, but very much used to be able to call to mind in action when you're under pressure, when you need to make decisions, when you need to deliberate, or when you need to reflect and sit back. Helping people recognize themselves in that.
I certainly, particularly in work that is at the programmatic level, where we have, you know, people all coming together for the same structured program. One of the things that struck me for many years is what is not helpful is to offer a homogenous experience to people as if they were going to become this, you know, homogenous archetypal leader. And it's been so important, I think, through particularly the experiential part of working with leaders to allow them the space to grow the confidence in becoming more of the leader that they are rather than that they think their organization wants. Because there's quite a pressure, I think, from organizations that is perceived anyway of what a good leader is. And it's linked to, you know, the values on the wall and to what their sector perceives as being important. And I think sometimes leaders can get a bit lost in, you know, finding themselves in that.
Yeah. And often when they, so the values on the wall, like you mentioned, you know, often people say, well, what do they mean? So then those values get broken down with definitions and they get, what does that mean? Okay, well, it looks like this in terms of behavior, but that's not like me. It's like, it was open to interpretation when they were values on the wall. And now we end up defining them and tying people in knots rather than developing the capacity for people to be able to trust themselves to act into the values that are valued across us, but also within us.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's not just trust in themselves, but the organization trust in them to make good judgments. And often, you know, one of my straplines has been, you know, good leadership is about being clear on the boundaries, being clear on what the sort of overarching intention is, making sure there's sufficient resources and getting out the way, you know, let people have the space to do what they do better than you probably can do.
Yeah. You bring them in for a reason and then end up, you know, in danger of like packaging people up into boxes and wonder why they get frustrated when you staple things to their heads. They're going to complain, you know, if you staple stuff to their heads that they just don't believe in, that doesn't quite link to their own capacity to, you know, align with something, to develop their capability to be given their own autonomy to thrive. It always fascinates me.
So we're going to explore a bit about context and your work in this space. But before we do that, do you want to describe a little bit about the type of work that you do with leaders and with teams, just to give us a sense of who you are?
Yeah. So when you were saying about this homogenous leader, you know, as if we can develop a program that is homogenized for everybody to experience. I think that in itself is, for me, the sort of, when you were saying that, I was thinking, as if we have the capacity to decide what someone's going to learn. You know, we can't decide what someone's going to learn. So most of my work is around providing creating a container, if you like, a space for leaders to come together. They know they have a vast amount of knowledge of their life, their experience, their work. I have some knowledge around some theory, some practice, some experiential practices. And we bring those together in a space, and there may be 10 of us, there may be 20 of us, there could be 50 of us, you know, and sometimes there can be 300 of us. But bringing those things together in a way that then it's like you've got some processes, you've got some content, they've got what they know, I've got what I know. And between us, we create the space for I will provide them with enough impetus and provocation, and then they do the work. And it's my job to sort of keep them in, keep them trusting, recognizing patterns around conflict, around values, around what I say and what I do. And me, because I'm in there as well. And I'm often learning about myself as much as they're learning about themselves. Usually it's part of a program, very often part of a program. So there is, you know, there is a pattern to what we're trying to do, because an organization has asked us to help promote certain behaviors, which often rely on the primary one is who am I in this? So get it, helping people understand who am I, so that they're able to develop their own capacity to work out what it is that I need to do with some provocation from me, either in terms of here's a model, or here's a story, or here's a framing, or here's an experience that I don't know what will happen for you, but I know something will happen, and developing that trust for them to be able to step into that space and be like, but doing it anyway. I love creating, a lot of my work is around creating a tension, putting people under some pressure, because I know through our research at Ashridge, the emotional learning goes deeper and lasts longer.
Yeah.
So the difference being from everyday life is you create the space for the reflection on that learning, on that experience, so that it becomes part of the repertoire of learning rather than just something that happened yesterday.
Well, I think let's come back to this point later in the conversation, because I think there's something that I think would be interesting to explore in terms of where the work is done.
Yes.
And particularly in programmatic multi-modular programs. I guess one of my reflections over the years is there's the work that we might do when everybody's there in the room, and then there's what happens in between. And for me, the work is as much the in-between, if not more, than what happens for those few days in the room. But let's pick that bit up as we get into the work more specifically. We've had COVID-19 and the impact that that's had at an organizational, at a societal, at an economic level, and of course fundamentally at a health and well-being level. I sometimes wonder if we in leadership teams pay enough attention to the context and the environment, and sometimes it can feel like we can get lost with what's happening inside our walls. But of course that hasn't been the case this last 12 months. We've had to look beyond our walls because life isn't the same on the outside anymore. I wonder, and this will be a really sort of inanely obvious question, but how would you describe the context for the people that you've been working with over this last year?
It's interesting because this last few weeks there's been a shift. So I think most people have been, what do we need to do to get through this? Either from a mental health perspective, but also just from having a job perspective. You know, is our company going to survive this? Are we able to do this? Oh, how do we reframe quickly? So lots of things that were in place before COVID, you know, like things like sign-offs and, you know, some of the mitigations that people have around the way they work, the processes, have literally had to go out the window because one might be in Stockholm and someone else is in London. And normally they'd be coming together, flying in, flying here, doing this, meeting up.
Yeah.
And we've all been in our rooms, our flats, our homes, our sheds in the garden, wherever we are. And I think the mentality has been, I want to do a good job. I want to keep us surviving. I want to find a way to thrive enough to get through this, with a kind of end point, but also this, you know, the new normal. So trying to find ways that this is sustainable, but still with an idea that there's an end point. And the last few weeks, a lot of the work that I've been doing, the conversations are shifting towards, okay, so now we're opening up in theory. What's good about what yeah. we've had and what we've discovered? What is just simply not sustainable? It was fine when we were finding a way to survive. But actually, that was a choice that I made, but it yeah. was a choice that I made while we were in survival mode. It's not how I would choose to work if this was a plan. This is how yeah. I was going to design it. I'll do it because I want, you know, I put my commitment in it because there's a lack of alternative.
Yeah.
But if the alternatives open up, that's definitely not what I would choose. Mm. So the conversation's moving to what can we keep hold of that was really good about this? You know, the space yeah. to think, the no commuting, the pointless commuting.
Yeah.
But also what is in that commute? So something, a colleague and I were talking about the transitional other that's now lost.
Mm.
The space between work and home, I mean, literally yep. drive home. Sometimes that drive home was when you took the best thinking, you know,
yeah, just, yeah.
and moving from home, from work to home. Like you felt the difference as you were driving. You might yeah. listen to the radio, you have a little song. Flying somewhere, that transitional mm-hmm. other space of the colour, the sights, the sounds of people, of other, of voices, of language, of smells, mm. of taste, of the interactions with people that you just can't predict. You know, that I'm something I personally am missing. And the more I'm sort of saying, this is kind of something I'm missing, people go, God, yeah, that I hadn't even thought. Oh, I'd love some of that.
Mm.
Because all of that is data, you know, in a some sense or other. It's all part and parcel of how we calculate humans, how we operate, how we trust, how we have relationships. So that transitional other, mm. there's something like that. So that's the conversations I'm noticing, is what was good, actually, of all that horrendousness of COVID?
Yeah.
Some good. There's space for the planet to breathe. There's space for us to breathe. There's space for us to just go, well, hang on a second. If I'm going to think about this, now we've had this jolt.
Yeah.
A friend of mine called it a reckoning. This yeah. is a time for a reckoning of going, actually, if we want to tally things up, what would I want to be left with? So that's what I think is really sort of shifting at the moment, is we're moving out of survival mode and going, okay, if we're really going to strive forwards, thrive,
mm.
what do we let go of? What do we hold on to? Because we now have evidence around yeah. stuff like presenteeism.
Yeah.
When does a leader just want me in the office because that's their preference? And when does it actually make sense for us mm. to be together?
One of the parts of that conversation that I'm intrigued by is the balance in there's what the organization as this thing thinks it needs. And obviously we've seen some organizations come out and say, you know, it's up to you, it's your choice. Some say, no, it's all going to be working from home, and others say, you know, this isn't how we work, it's all going to be back in the office. And what strikes me as one of the areas that isn't really being talked about is, where is the balance, where should the balance be in terms of whether the organization dictates or whether the individual chooses? And the bit, I guess, from the work that I do that I feel is missing in the conversation is, and what's the impact at the team level, particularly if it ends up in a hybrid model, and particularly if it's, you know, I think we all want to have agency and choice over what our future working patterns and styles will be going forward. And I think it has an impact at the team level in terms of, how do we make decisions going forward? How do we make sure that we have the right people involved in each of the conversations, irrespective of what their choices might be about where they work or when they come in? And I think there's just something at the team lens that needs paid attention to, that doesn't dictate, but it has to be part of the understanding of, well, we might need to shift some of how we work at the team level to accommodate either the organization or the individuals.
Because there's also that one of the conversations I had within the last couple of weeks, several of them, was around the sort of critical mass of people. You know, when do we have it that once a week we all come into the office? Do we have it that once a month we all come into the office? Do we have a week, a month when we all come into the office? But what it kind of struck me as was that does presume that decisions are made face to face. And, you know, and who has the privilege of being face to face? Who chooses not to but is missing out because they don't want to come in?
Yeah.
I can remember when we were working with a large public sector organisation, and the move was to be more localised, people to be able to, you know, so that the whole of the country could flourish, in effect, rather than it being in pockets.
Yeah. Or super centralised.
Super centralised. And while that's said, the reality is this sort of sense of, hang on, if I'm not there, I won't have my, I need to be there. So whether it's said and done, but what actually plays out in practice is this sense of who's in the room and who gets to make, it's a bit like the old days of decisions being made on the golf course.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the metaphor still stands. It's just a different golf course. You know, the golf course has changed.
Well, and I think in some ways, I've heard some organisations talk about the use of remote technology as democratising. You know, more people can be in a conversation. I've also heard people feeling it quite autocratic because actually there's usually a host that can decide, you know, muting or not, or, you know, who gets in or not. But what it raises for me is that it would benefit bringing greater transparency to how our decisions made, and you know, picking up on the example that you used, very often I think there are levels of decisions that need sort of levels of seniority of support, and if you have got centralized areas where seniority sits particularly in certain places, how do we better lift the lid on how those decisions will be made, so that those, whether they're localized or whether they're choosing to work remotely, are still involved and, you know, are part of that decision-making process. So for me, there's just something that says it's not just about I should have the choice of where to work. It's about what is the nature of the work and how are we going to, as the team, as the department, how are we going to do this, that again gets the best from each person and the collective, and make sure that we don't go backwards in terms of some of our unintended exclusions.
And what it's making me think about is the risk that the decision making gets formalized in a way to make sure it's fair and inclusive, and actually we lose that, you know, I guess I'm thinking about the line between the relational and the process. I notice I'm doing this for process and this for relational, you know, and the beautiful relationships that you can have, but the dark side of that is who's in and who's out, you know, who's in your relationship group and who's out of your relationship group, and how that impacts on things, like, so that it's a very fine line between how do we make decisions because we happen to see each other in a corridor, we go that thing, oh yeah, that thing, yeah, let's do that, that's great, and then the third person in our group is like, trusts us enough to know that if we had that conversation. But if that trust isn't there and that third person's going, hang on a second, why wasn't I part of that? What's, and they're feeling othered.
Yeah.
That's a nuanced decision-making process that is beautiful when it works well, as in, and it is fair with trust.
Yeah.
It's when it's not.
Well, and of course it would be nice to think that all decision-making is planned. And that we understand when it's coming, and that we can all have done, you know, played our part, and understand what the choices are. But much of the decisions can come from left field, or something comes in and it's a very tight turnaround. And the risk is it's either those that you're proximity closest to or relationally closest to that you involve, because you've got, you know, very little time. I think there's just something that says in the hybrid model, that will need to be more transparent than ever before, and possibly, you know, require leaders to think and act in ways that they haven't had to. You know, you said it was, what do we do to survive this period? But now we're talking about, well, if this is the sort of permanent way going forward, how does this work in practice? And it is that sort of practical sniff test of, does it really work? That I think there's a lot to be done at the team level that starts with, what's your preference? How do you want to work? And let's see what the collection of preferences multiplied by the organizational needs shows up like in terms of what the various aspects of our teaming require.
And also the humility for leaders to recognize what's their preference rather than what the task preference is. You know, what's necessary given the situation, and what is actually my preference. So a friend of mine was, you know, it works so well, they're working virtually. So let's just make it a permanent thing and sell the offices.
Yeah.
The offices that the person had bought a flat very close to, so they didn't have to commute.
Yeah.
Flat just before lockdown, one bedroom small flat in central London.
Yeah.
To be close to commute. And this whole asset in the middle of London is now closing. And there they are in a central London flat, little one, when they could have moved anywhere and had, you know, a big house. And, you know, it's all choices, and we live with our consequences of our choices. We can't be beholden, you know, we can't expect people to do things like that. But just, you know, it just paying attention to, yes, it worked, but is that a sustainable model? It worked while people were trying to survive and get through it. But now moving forward, just because it worked then, it doesn't mean it's going to work now. What got us here won't necessarily get us there.
Yeah. But I love your point about, you know, taking time, whether as the individual leader or as the team, to reflect on the experience. You know, what have we learned? What has worked well for us? What is sustainable? What isn't? And make some choices consciously rather than, you know, kind of that binary flip the switch and it's either back to normal or, you know, let's just keep doing what we're doing. Because I think there'll be a few bumps that just need some navigation. So can I ask you, what does being in a team mean today?
Good question. Yeah, it's a good question. It really does now pivot around the task and the relationship. You know, that those two things. What are we doing here? Because it's almost like Zoom, like any phone call. You only pick up the phone. If you go back, like when we were kids, if you were making a phone call, it was for a reason.
Yeah.
You pick up the phone for a reason. Unless you're like phoning your best mate or your mum, you know, and you might be like, I'm going to talk about nonsense for, I don't know, however long you're allowed to be on the phone for. But typically, a phone call has a task. So you phone up, there's a thing, you go, you get it done, you put the phone down, you arrange yourself. And I think that mentality still sits a bit around Zoom to some degree. So we put in things around time for connecting, but there's still always a task. And even if the task is to connect, there's still a task attached to it. And so I've really noticed that the relationships that were present before have got deeper. The ones that were, I can't remember what the expression is, but a loose connection.
Yeah, friendship, more peripheral, perhaps.
More peripheral, have fallen away because there's no reason to contact them. Unless there's a reason to contact them, it's like, I'm thinking of it, it's a bit like synaptic connections in the brain.
Yeah.
Some are just getting much deeper and some are falling away because there's no need to contact someone that you don't have a need to contact, that you haven't seen them. So unless it's really pivoting around the task and the relationships, the sense of team, like the broader team, can easily fall away.
So I have a slightly different view or a different experience of that in relation to those peripheral relationships. And I think my experience has been, and this is where it's so interesting to contextualize it to the pandemic period, is I have a much more viscerally felt set amount of energy. And if I've got this finite energy, I've put it more into the relationships that have depth and less into the relationships that haven't.
Yeah,
and So it's not that I didn't have a reason to connect with them, but I really kind of honed in more on, if I can only do so much, I'm going to have to be choiceful, probably more choice. I mean, and it's funny, it's kind of should probably have been more choiceful before and now too choiceful. But I'm curious, in your experience, if it's task and it's relationship, where does the stuff that we don't yet know, the creative stuff, the innovation, where does that sit in a team, in how you described it?
Currently, very likely. And I think that's one of the problems. It's very likely. It's very likely.
Likely.
Because exactly back to your energy point, it's, you know, where do you get your energy from to be creative, to be innovative? Where does it come from? What's the impetus? Where does the stimulus come from? For some people, it's, you know, it's from, you know, nature or being with others. It's this and the other. But to plan time to have that now is almost impossible. And to have it in the space that you really require, especially if it's a team creativity, like how are we going to do this differently? In a Zoom call, it becomes very, we have to do this, then we have to have breakouts, then we're in breakouts, we've got breakout for this amount of time, we got this, and then someone's monitoring, and then we get pulled back in. And that fluidity, I'm sure it's created somewhere, feeling like a laggard. I'm still struggling to even really know where my creativity came from before, because I wasn't, it would happen. Yeah. I would have creative moments, and now I'm having fewer of them, and I'm trying to work out what's that ingredient that's missing, and I haven't quite caught up with where what that is to be able to design it into. So if I'm struck, you know, I haven't quite got the language around it, but that.
So I did some work on neuroscience in the last couple of months, and I think there's something interesting in that space in terms of, in particular, the brainwave that it is more likely for creativity and insight to happen is not the same brainwave that is in operation or existing, if you like, when we're doing the planning, the analytical, which, as you described, you know, when we're organizing a Zoom, there's a task, there's a purpose. It's stimulating a part of the brain, and it's stimulating us in a way that switches on all of those existing neural pathways, but it's not about the space where we're making new connections. Mm-hmm. So I think there's something just about that probably isn't the space for the conditions for us to be our most creative, our most innovative. But I also wonder, is it somewhat linked to what you described earlier, is that transitional space? And again, it does link back to, we kind of switch off the conscious thinking and we go into the unconscious, and those things just ping around our minds, whether we're sat on the train with our, you know, earplugs in, or whether we're, you know, looking out the train window. There's something about our ability to be away from the expectation and the doing and just be in the being. And I certainly think, you know, as a working parent, the space for being in this time hasn't felt very easy to kind of shift into. I mean, we can give ourselves 20 minutes to do a practice of whatever kind, but do I feel like I've really kind of centered and stopped the to-do list that's going on in my head? Less so. I think very much less so. There's just so much being juggled.
And by default, by definition, rather, that you have a plan to do a practice means that you're setting yourself up with a bit of a task to do a practice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas there's something about that transitional other. I guess if we go back to like cavemen, it's when you've fed, you've caught something to eat, you don't feel threatened, you're not asleep, and you can just be together, either in commune or by yourself, and knowing you're not necessarily, you know, you have to be a bit alert because if you're driving, it'd be quite good to be a bit alert when you're driving. But you can just be present with what is around you, and it's not actively trying to meditate to kind of notice your brain and everything else. It just is. It's just there's a kid crying over there, and you can see the mum, you know, and you just kind of go, "Oh, I remember that," you know, and you just think about, "Oh, yeah, I remember that when that little market was." And then
I just think to myself, "I'm so grateful, you know, to be past that stage." And I, you know, you just send her this sort of, you know, silent prayer of support because you've been
And it just says that chance for your brain just to scuttle around and notice some patterns, and oh, that's interesting, like, you know.
But not at a conscious level, I think.
Not at a conscious level.
Yeah. Which then does allow that sense of, you know, when you're saying noticing the patterns, again, it's not even at a cognitive conscious level. Mm-mm. It's for me, you know, whether it's the commute, whether it's the shower, whether it's the falling asleep time, there's so much more likelihood of connections, insights, new ideas than when I'm sat at the desk or even on, you know, calls. And I think there's just something about in this prospect of hybrid working, what does that new space look like that we can promote, particularly when we do it coming together, a way to make sure that we don't lose the possibility of creativity, innovation, collaboration, which are, we know, are fundamental to the survival of organizations.
It's making me think about a paper by Fletcher, who wrote about the relational work, how the relational work is work. You know, so all the things that happen in between, so not the task and not the job and not the meetings with the agendas, but it's everything that happens in between, is often seen as an idiosyncratic thing that, you know, Debbie's just quite relational. Mm. But actually it is work. It is part of the work. It is part of, I think of it as being the sort of mortar to the bricks of the organisation. Mm. It's what gets things flowing and keeps, and if you stop doing it, things fall to a halt. And I think this is part of that. There's something about, yes, we're missing the social, but it's so much more than the social. It's so much more than the transitional other. It's what that space and that that opportunity gives us in terms of how we are operating as an organisation, whether it be relationally, task, whatever it is. And given that it is work and it is contributing to how we work, I suppose I would like to see us as organisational leaders or if whatever we're doing around here, to help leaders recognise that it's a space that is required, not just a nice to have.
Yeah.
It's not just a something Debbie needs sometimes, you know, that's...
Yeah.
It's actually something that we all need, and we can claim it. We can say it as a boundary thing. This is space that I need. It is still work.
Yeah.
Me going for a walk in the middle of the day is not me trying to cope. It is an essential part of connecting with myself, with other, with the space beyond this rectangle.
It's kind of at its core, it's in essence being human. Yes. And so I think it's interesting, the way that we talk about it is nearly apologetic. It's like we need it, we all need it, and you're like, well, we do all need it, yes, to varying degrees. But if I can just mash up your analogy a little bit, where you compared it to the mortar, to, you know, holding the bricks together, there's something about the quality of that mortar. You know, when it's too watery or too gritty, too sandy, it affects the quality of the wall. When the mortar is not there at all, we're just individual bricks, nothing collectively of any kind of sturdiness that can withstand the pressure exists. And I think, I think there have been organizations in this last period where, you know, if the mortar has been a bit thin, and there hasn't been enough of that quality of connection, you know, the wall has started to crack or the blocks have started to crumble. So I do think there's something that more people, I think, probably have felt and experienced this past year, that you might have been talking about intuitively for, you know, many years, but that we've all got, we've all now had direct experience of what was missing. And not just in the work environment, you know, in our family environment, in our community environments, all the things that we didn't realize we needed to feel like the sense of belonging and of purpose and of meaning of who we are. Because going back to your, you know, your very first intro, of course, it's not just about working with leaders in whatever role they happen to be in. It's in their fullness as a person, you know, what other roles they have. Because in my experience, it doesn't serve us well to separate them entirely.
Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, the saying and the doing. You know, often we'll work with leaders and the organisational leaders that say we want this as part of our organisation, and then squeeze it out. You know, you can be human on your own time. This is work. You know, surely that maybe this, you know, someone said the other day, maybe it's me just being old fashioned. It's like, no, it's you being unkind, actually. You know, it's like in this instance, that what you're suggesting is stripping out the human and turning them back into a cog because it's your preference.
Yeah,
to some degree,
or it's faster.
There's an efficiency to it. Yeah. That's great. It will get the job done, but it, on a project level. But in terms of sustainable practice across years, you're either going to lose them or they're going to burn out.
Yeah.
So take your pick. You can't keep going at that level and be sustainable for beyond kind of a project mentality. Get in, get the job done, get out. Great. That's a...
Well, and I think we do often. Look at it in terms of what we lose if we're not treated as or respected in our humanness. But I think also there's the upside to when we're at our best in our humanness, what we can achieve together because we feel respected, because we feel valued, because we respect how others do things differently. And it's that kind of space that's unexplored territory often, because we're still fighting for, you know, those basic human, you know, needs. Can you share, I know you have a wonderful model that you use to describe and to kind of plot nearly the nature of work that you do in leadership development. And what I'm curious about, if you wouldn't mind explaining the model, is where you would position working with a team in that model.
It's funny, because as you're saying that, I'm thinking, which model does she mean?
I mean,
there's a couple that I find myself playing with.
Well, tell us both of them. And then, I mean, the one I was talking about was the planned emergent content process. And... But you obviously thought of another one as well. We'd love to hear them.
So the planned emergent content process one was just such a helpful way of thinking about, well, what are we trying to do here? You know, so there are things that we can plan. So there's a there's the content. This is what we're trying to do. There's a, you know, there's a in leadership development terms, the content would be a model, a framework, a story. It's a me talking about a specific thing.
So trust, engagement.
Resilience.
Yeah. You
know, there's a content piece that you
all
don't
know. All the topics,
that that you don't know that I know.
Yeah.
Or you might not know. I can presume as you're on a program, you might not know about this. And that's, you know, we can plan that in because we know that this organization might be losing out on some kind of sense of resilience or whatever is the topic. So we can plan that in based on the customization. And then there's also the processes, and we can plan those in. So there's things like experiential learning. There's things like coaching sessions, action learning sets and whatever. We can plan that in. And then there's what emerges as a result of that. So the emergent content can be, well, actually, we need more here around. We thought it was around work-life balance, but actually we realised there's a whole thing around fairness here that is actually underpinning this work-life balance kind of tug and pull of what feels fair. So then we will emerge. What will emerge will be a conversation. It might be a theory, or it might be, again, a story of another organisation that you work with, or something that is a piece of knowledge or understanding to help people have new knowledge and understanding.
Mm.
And of course, that doesn't mean anything unless it's put into practice, unless you do something with it. So for you to be able to see it in action, to be able to go, I thought I was a really fair person, but under pressure, I actually got quite unfair. I demanded this of someone when I really, it wasn't fair to. If it just stays at the theory level, people are very convinced about what they can do and what they can't do. You know, it's like, well, I'm a fair person. Of course I'm a fair person. But there's something about that experience of coming to know that you then realise. And when this played out in practice was I did I didn't do a sailing race. I researched the sailing race. And people started the race, you know, being aware of they're in a race. You know, they want to win a race. Or they might say, you know, looking forward to being part of a winning team. But in the reality of the experience for lots of us, like, if that's what it's going to take, I'm happy with a middle, you know, the reality of what it actually takes to see themselves in action and know what's required of them, it requires a reshift and a framing. So how this would play out with teams is there's something about what we're doing, and we know we're doing, and we say that's what we're doing.
So it's a clarity of intention.
But it's through the experience. So we are operating in experiential ways. We're literally doing the work and working with each other. But we might find that we have conflict, or we might find that through our doing this thing in action, that we need to readjust. And so there's something about that. And when do we then say taking that out of stepping out? What do we need to do differently? And then putting it into practice with what has emerged with us as a team. So it's constantly paying attention to what we said we were going to do and how we said we were going to do it. But actually, what's the new need, given what's emerging for us? What do we need to think about differently? So I was working with a group a couple of months ago, wonderful team, really intact, really close. So close, they found it difficult to have difficult conversations. They found it difficult to actually say, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
So they found ways around it and still very much in love with each other. You know, it was wonderful to work with them and to see that conflict just being kept to one side and just calling it, saying it, naming it. Bit of resistance. But then once they're like, yeah, we are really polite with each other sometimes, mostly. And just that naming the politeness from a good place. You know, not fearful, not
blaming,
power, not blaming, just wanting to keep this lovely buoyancy that they had, that there was these big lumps of things that were just getting in their way and they're all trying to work out ways around it and just naming it. They were then able to change their experience.
I think, so just for our listeners, if you can imagine there's a horizontal line. And at one end, it's planned, and one end, it's emergent.
So side to side is content and process, and up and down is planned and emergent. So planned content, planned process, emergent content, emergent process.
Yeah, so four quadrants. And the reason that I think this is an interesting frame to consider when you're working with teams is I think there's something about, and it is that sort of clarity of intention to start with, but helping people understand it's through the doing that we'll learn, but we have to keep taking those process pauses to step out of the doing, to reflect on what we've noticed, perhaps to go back to what is it we're trying to do here, and make our way back into what is inevitably emergent. But I think it, for me, that model really helps to recognize that whatever the thing is, and there's always going to be a thing in every team because it's a collection of dynamic people, that the work really is in the doing rather than in the planned
and the plan, what you
content.
Thought.
Even though, and this, you know, might be a little bit gritty, but even though there's very often quite a tie back to, well, what was agreed that this plan process would be? You know, this isn't what I signed up to, or not what HR expected, or, and there's something just about, for me, teamwork has to be more emergent than planned, and there will be a structure Absolutely, but it's a light structure, and it's going with what's actually happening, which goes to the point you made earlier, or we were starting to talk about earlier, which is where is the real work done? And is it, you know, there's a lot of it can be in those sort of 2-3 days, whatever it is, that is well facilitated and well structured and well thought out. But in my experience with teams, it can't be left in that space at that time. It has to be brought to life in everything that they do.
And that's why with a program, if you're ever going to be on a program with me, the content is only a part of it. The content is something to hang your hat on.
Yeah.
Most of the work is, and how do you do something with it? You know, how do you actually take this out and do something with it? Because if you're not taking it out and doing something with it, I might as well be just talking to the camera. The other model, which is more specific to teams, was around the sailing race. And again, it's that it's ultimately it's an emergent model. You've got three parts. At a very simplest level, you can either be high or low on any one of them, and in any team at any point. And it's recognising, well, what's the need for our team at the moment? What do we need? So one of them is around alignment. And what was really surprising about alignment, people have to say, we have to be aligned, we have to get buy-in, we have to explain to people what we're trying to do, and then they'll get it. They'll get it then. And then, you know, if they're you know, resistant or whatever, people go, they obviously don't understand what we're trying to do. We need to tell them more. And it's not that they don't understand, they get it, but it doesn't matter to them. They get it. They're not going to argue that we need to do this by Q2, you know, or whatever is the thing that we're all trying to do. But with the model, with the sailing race, what the teams that were differentiated, because some presumed we're here to win. Obviously you're here to win and I'm here to win because it's a sailing race. And we presumed that as we came into the research. Of course you're going to want to win. It's a sailing race. It's a race. But what was particularly interesting as we went through the research was the winning meant different things to different people. And so for some, it's like, yeah, I get it's a race, but to be honest, for me, it's about the charity that I'm raising money for, or a charity I'm raising awareness of. I don't want to come last. I want to see something amazing I'd never see in any other walk of my life. You know, I want an adventure. I want to see dolphins, or, you know, whatever it is. And the teams that differentiated were the ones that, yes, there's the big picture of where we're going. We're heading to San Francisco. That's by this date.
Yep.
You know, there's an intention. But that also heard that was part of, but it wasn't only. There was also these other things. And when teams really came together, I'm listening to you wanting that adventure. So I'm conscious of what would give Debbie a sense of adventure. And being able to say, look, you know, look over there, there's something amazing. And being conscious of my need for that charity or whatever it is, as long as they're going in the same direction, they're not incongruent with each other. You don't have to have just one thing. It's paying attention to everybody's things and assuming they're going in the same direction. Like, you're not going to turn the boat back to go and see something amazing, because then we're never going to get to San Francisco by that date. So alignment, how aligned are you? Alignment being not just we all agree with one thing,
yep,
but we all can buy into that big thing because we're also being met on my individual thing.
Yeah.
Whereas low is, I don't care if you don't get it. I just need you to do it. I just need you to turn up and do it. Or I don't care if, you know, I don't buy into the organisation. I just need to earn some money. You know, so that's alignment. It's just a very simple, it's not very simple.
And at its high, what you're making me think is that can't then come from top down. That's something that's co-created by those people, which is why it's always interesting when we talk about alignment. I think alignment is at the team level rather than at the, you know, far away organizational level.
The only way it comes from the top is if that person at the top is really inspiring. So they have a passion and they create a beacon for people to want to move towards. That's the only way it comes from the top, is that people kind of go, I want to work with that person. I absolutely get what they're saying, what they're selling, what they're telling. And that's when it can come from the top. But to presume you have that amount of, like, inspirational power is quite, you know, a risk in itself.
Well, it doesn't come with title.
It definitely doesn't come with title. So either they created a beacon for people to want to move towards, and that ultimately that's where it ended up. It ended up with the beacon of people kind of going, I want us to do well because for the people on my team who want to win, I care enough that I'm going to try and go the extra mile, not because I necessarily want to win, but because I want them to win.
Yeah.
I want them to have this because I can see how important it is. And because I get my thing, and that sounds quite transactional, but it's done with a real kind of sense of relationship and reciprocity. And I am felt and recognised and belong. There was one woman who just had no interest. She got on the boat thinking she was going to sail. She hated it. And she just did the cooking. Please, can I just do the cooking? Can I take care of the food and this? And I will make sure you have tasty food. And she contributed to this bigger thing by doing that because she knew she couldn't do the thing.
Yeah.
So alignment is one, high-low.
Yep.
Capability is, you know, literally the technical skills to do what it is that you're doing and the resources. And that's one thing we've struggled with, I think. Have you got a printer? Have you got a screen? Have you got two screens?
Yeah.
You know, what's the expectation of what we do ourselves and what's the expectation of an organisation to come and fit us with this huge office?
Yeah.
But the capability of communicating well, dealing with conflict, feedback, the human stuff, the stuff around how do we actually do that, which requires that kind of coming and going of what's actually needed. But people with higher alignment tend to want to develop their capability in line with the thing that we're trying to do. People with lower alignment, you tell me what box to tick, I'll tick it. If I have to tick a box, I'll tick it.
Yeah.
But it will be a very transactional thing. And the last part is autonomy. And that's the scope. And this is the one where it takes. So the alignment is an ongoing piece. The capability is an ongoing piece. The autonomy really does require a very high kind of alertness, if you like, or coming alongside. When do you come alongside? When do you tell? When do you go hands off? And it will depend on the level of capability and alignment. If someone really highly capable and very highly aligned, get out of their way.
Yeah.
They will do it and do it well because they want to do well. They want us to do well. If someone's brand new, you come alongside. When do you tell? When do you coach?
Yeah.
And that can be a team level, not just a top down. That's us. When a team is done well, I can coach you as my peer.
Yeah.
Because I have some knowledge or skill that you might need. And I can come alongside and coach you. I don't have to tell you how to do something, for example.
So two questions, if I may.
Please.
One is, and I'll just tell you them both, but one is, so what's the role of the skipper in this model? And the second, just as you described that, the autonomy will vary depending on the sort of capability multiplied by alignment. Coming back to our current context, one of the things that I think has been harder in this virtual world is how we do well support people joining organizations or people coming into their careers for the first time. And so there's something about how do we judge along that sort of autonomy line if we don't have that relationship in that same way. We haven't had that face to face. We've done it all through this. How do we see? And if we don't know the person, how do we know what we're looking for in building that, you know, trust? Because there's trust that comes with autonomy. How do we build that with people that we don't know as well?
So the role of the skipper, it was interesting actually, because depending on their background, where they came from, but if I was to take it as a generic thing, again, it's back to that container. They have a lot of knowledge, they have a lot of skill, and they have a lot of experience, you know, that they're drawing on all the time. But one of the skippers was very much, look, I need to sleep. I can't sleep. He said, so for me, getting the team to a point where they are able to sail this boat, make good quality decisions between them, you know, in line with what the big intention is, we need to get to San Francisco. If they're making the quality decisions, I need to get them to a point where I can trust them to make the decisions. They don't have to make the same decisions, but they have to be the same quality of decisions so that ultimately I can go to sleep.
Yeah.
So metaphorically, I don't have to be doing everything.
Yeah.
They are the ones doing. He provided the frame, the security. So there was a security element there that literally they'd done this a lot. So that you could go and say, what do we do? There's someone to say, what do you think you do? Or in this instance, we're going to do this, you know, whatever. Is that step in, step back?
Yeah.
Is it a development opportunity? Is it actually something just needs to happen? But they created the container for the others to sail the boat.
Yeah. Okay.
So that with a safety element and in reality, a refereeing element sometimes because there was conflict. But without it being an escalating first step.
Yeah.
Creating the capability for people to be able to resolve for themselves those conflicts.
You're reminding me of a book, Turn the Ship Around.
Yes. I haven't read it, but I've heard about it.
Which is very much in this space of, building the capability at the level at which the decisions need to be made. And as you say, sort of using the hierarchy to support those as they come to more complex decisions rather than as a control mechanism.
Yeah.
Which
links directly to the, so the command and control model, the actual military command and control model was the one that explained what was going on the boats in a way that I really didn't want it to. I was very resistant to having command and control in my kind of explanation. But I was taking command and control from an organisational perspective, how we see it in the organisation. It's top down, I tell you, it's directive. But the reality of command and control are the constraints that we're working under or that are put upon us, depending on our level of authority.
Mm.
Command is the human creativity and will to act within those constraints. And so the higher up you go, you have a wider constraint of which you can operate within. But ultimately, you're making your decisions based on human creativity and will. Obviously, capability and all the rest of it. Like, are you actually able to make those decisions? So that really explained, so there were different, the hierarchy was just some people, not literally on the boat because it was volunteer, but they weren't paid. But some people were paid more to take different decisions and take different risks within a constraint and the human creativity and will that they have. So the people, the skippers on the boats were creating the container with constraints, but for people to have their creativity and will within them, to be able to understand their decisions, how it links to that, rather than pull that handle for the next 6 months.
Mm.
You know, that's at a basic level, but metaphorically is how do we create that capability for people to be able to, given the constraints, the controls, you're not going to let someone who's brand new come in and just sail the ship unless you know they've got 20 years experience and they've, you know, they're highly capable.
Yeah.
And anyway, and then the other question you had was how do we bring people in? The differentiator in the sailing race, which I do think actually translates across, was yes, there is an element of the capability in terms of what we're doing around here. You know, you need to know who to speak to and how to get your laptop set up and how do you do these things. And there is an element of that. But actually, at some point, you can only take in so much of that. Mm. And really, it's a relational thing. That to be able to spend time to understand who are you. So that was one of the things on the boats and happens in real life. That was real life, but you know what I mean? That those people came on with stories. They were brand new. So that the people that around the world have been on that boat for, you know, a long time.
Yeah.
The people that really differentiated, took the time to listen to those stories. What do they know? If they said, why didn't we do that? Why do you do it like that? They were able to say, do you have a different view? And they go, well, I was just thinking if, you know, and they'd either take it on board, but they wouldn't say, it's just the way we do things. It's how we do things around here. You know, there was a valuing the person coming in for what they're bringing in with them.
Yeah.
And that capability to bring them and genuinely integrate, not just, I'm going to give you a buddy and you're going to stand on the side and watch.
Yeah.
You're actually going to be integrated and that time to just come and be part of and talk to. rather than given lots of data.
What springs to mind for me as you describe that is sort of an orientation and an openness to learning more about the other and how they will contribute and perhaps the areas that they need to work on. And there being sort of a very obvious vested interest that this new team member is sort of useful and valued, and that you understand them well enough, both so that their needs are met, but also so that the sort of tight team needs are met. I wonder sometimes, as teams fluctuate so often in the sort of organizational world, whether that shared vested interest is always as keenly felt when team members are changing in and out. And it shows up, you know, in the quality of often how well we induct a new member, but we don't close out or end very consciously with somebody that's leaving.
Good endings.
And yet there's ripples in the dynamic of the team, both with the ending and with the introduction. So things I think to reflect on. I'm just sort of bringing this section to a close. I guess I'm curious whether you've got any thoughts around moments that mattered or hidden traps that you noticed, particularly around teams from that research. Whether it does anything stand out as, oh, that really made a difference, or that's something that does show up as a pattern in teams but very often we don't see?
It absolutely would be that people are there for different reasons and you can tap into that, which sounds obvious. But when you, to just really, you know, this was a race, this was a sailing race where there is a podium place. There's a gold, silver and bronze. Yeah. There are really clear understandings and parameters about what it takes to perform in that arena.
Yeah.
And yet people were there for such vast amounts of reasons. And yet we still think as organizations, groups of people thinking in organizations, that we can get everybody behind one idea as if that would be enough. You know, that just for a moment to just pause and go, well, what is that resource that's available if I were to really tap into what people really want from this? And it can still be part of the big picture. They don't cut across each other. They can be part and parcel. It just takes time.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
And I mean, I love that idea of tapping into the resource of that diversity of what drives people, what motivates them, what they want and get from it. And, you know, sort of resisting the urge to have to try and control it.
Yes.
And I think there is just something that it takes. It feels as though one has to be brave to allow others to have different drivers and alignment. And yet I do wonder if we could open that space just a bit more, what might that mean for what people feel they're possible to do when they're in the workplace, when they're, you know, I don't care what the place is, but when they're doing their work with their organization.
And just to fit that, remembering that people that don't make noise still need to be listened to.
Yeah.
You know, so that when you were saying about people coming on board, or you know, that as if they're not making a noise, they must be fine. And actually, they're either confused and they don't know who to ask, or they're not fine. And you know, they're.
I think the lack of noise for me is often a symbol of what am I missing here. And that's interesting, just as I was going to ask you, you know, as we sort of look to the future then, and it did sort of strike me that from a sort of introvert extrovert point of view, you know, I being an extrovert, you know, I'm very aware, I think, as I talk. That's how I do my thinking, is I do it through talking. And yet I know that means that I can take space when in a group situation. And I think there's just something in terms of when we're agreeing and figuring out what this future looks like, particularly in this virtual world. What would be your advice for people to engage and make space for everyone on the team in whatever their future working practices or choices might be?
It goes back to good conversation, you know, that are you having good conversations about it? Is there trust in the system that people are going to tell you what they think? And pay attention to the signals that you send, you know, around what are you creating a beacon for people to move towards, or you are creating a beacon of compliance. You know, that's the other, that those signals are just as strong. They're just sending different messages.
Yeah.
And, you know, so when people are coalescing, are they coalescing because they think it's what they should be doing?
Yeah.
Or is because they actually want to do it? So that, going back to the third model that I use quite a lot, is the want to, have to, should. Are you clear around what people want to do? They have energy for it, they'll find time for it, it engages them. What they have to do, there is an actual punishment if they don't. And their sense of should, which is, you know, either a positive should, I'm doing it because it will make her happy, I'm doing it because it's obviously the done thing around here, I will look good if I do that. Or it's a reciprocity, you know, I don't really want to do it, but Debbie's a good friend of mine, and in grand scheme of things, it will come back. Or the negative should, which is, it will be career limiting if I don't. I'll look bad. I'll embarrass myself. I won't look like a team player if I don't do this thing. If you just take simply like responding to emails, you know, where is our end of our day without this transitional other? Mm. We've got this, the potential, and depending on how your house is set up, your laptop is sat there all evening while you're watching some nonsense on telly. Oh, didn't do that thing. You know? And it's easy.
Yeah,
but what signals are we sending? If I want to send that email at 10 o'clock at night because it's in my intellectual capacity to go, oh, that's a thought, depending on the power, are my team responding to me genuinely because they're also going, this is really interesting, which could be a very powerful story we're telling ourselves, going, look at my engaged team, we're all firing on all cylinders just because we have this great idea. Forgetting that some people are going to be going, oh, I better, oh, should I? I don't want to. My resilience is low. I want to manage my boundaries. We've said we're going to manage our boundaries, but here we are at 10 o'clock sending each other emails.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to say, no, I'm not going to answer this, or I'm just not going to answer it without mentioning the no?
Yeah.
All of that takes time, effort, and energy.
Well, and for me, I think it's how to have those conversations at the team level, not just the binary.
Absolutely.
It's not about, can Sheila do this and Dave do that and Neha do this? It's how do each of these choices impact on each other? And what is it that we want to be? How do we want to be? And I think sometimes those conversations are hard for teams to step into and for leaders to want to step into, because it means you're kind of giving more more choice, more control, dare I say, across the team. One thing I just wanted, I guess, just as we're sort of coming to an end, is just, I think it's recognizing that when we're stepping into these conversations, that people have experienced this last 12 months very differently. There was a quote that I read, which I'll share with you if I may, which said, some individuals experienced an extraordinary time, and one even described it as a moment of destiny, whilst others felt marginalized, sacrificed, or abandoned. And I think for me, as we step into these conversations where we're starting to talk about what do we want our new norms to be, it's just recognizing and honoring the disparity of experience that people will have had, dependent on so many factors, you know, whether they had children, the type of role they had, where they live, whether they've lost someone, whether they've had, some degree of trauma or crisis during this last 12 months. And it's not kind of presuming from our own situation without recognizing and inviting that individual experience into the room as well.
So Somebody said to me yesterday, I've learned so much about myself this last year. I don't want that to be lost.
Mm.
You know, I don't want that to be lost. I don't want to just have to give it up. You know, I now know this about myself. I can't put it back in a box very easily.
And my hope in the working with team space is, how do we bring that in so that we can acknowledge and experience and utilize those learnings together? And I think it's just such an incredibly powerful opportunity, and yet it'll probably feel quite vulnerable, because we've probably learned things about ourselves that it's not all things that we like. You know, we've probably learned some things that we don't like, but thank goodness I know that about myself now. But how do we build and contribute together to a better way of being?
And also, what you just raised for me is, by having that conversation, it is out there, and there's a risk, you know, the seeking permission versus asking for forgiveness.
Yeah.
Something about, if I just go about my business and I do what I want because it serves me, I don't have to let anyone know. I can just do what I want to do. But if we have that conversation, the risk is, okay, so we have, you know, there is a consensus. We want some of us to be in the office a couple of days. I don't want to be in the office. You know, like, so that it raises the question of, if we actually have that conversation and totally need to have the conversation, it then presents us with the risk that we are opening up and having to bend to someone else.
Yep.
We want to bend to, because they're our colleague, but at the same time, I might not want to. I don't know if I'm ready for that. And that is what will be difficult.
And I think there has been the possibility that, because we've kind of curated our environment around us for a year now, and yes, we've had to make sacrifices, and yes, we've had to change things, but we've also had some degree of control over, you know, what our environment looks like, the immediate environment, the home environment. And the thought of having to give some of that up for the benefit of another, I think there is going to be a sort of mental, psychological shift that we need to allow and be open to again.
Yeah, where we want to be good people.
Yeah. So last few questions, if I may. What have you learned about yourself through working with leaders and teams?
Oh, that's a good one. I've learned my practice, actually. You know, what is it that gives me energy? What is it that I really enjoy? What is it that I don't enjoy? What is it that I would enjoy? It's just lots of huge amounts of data about how people are motivated, engaged, what excites them, what switches them off, what stories they tell themselves, and seeing myself in others and recognizing the patterns. And so really, I've learned a huge amount about myself through my work. It's like a constant bounce back of, what am I learning? What can I offer back? What am I learning? Yeah. What can I offer back?
And just from the practitioner experience, I think it's incredibly important that we are self-aware, that we recognize what's our stuff. We all have it. We're able to recognize, when we're working with groups in particular, what's happening within that group, what's my contribution, because we're never completely, you know, outside it. But recognizing that we play a part in it and can be changed by it, and have to be open to being changed by it. And sometimes, particularly, you know, go back to your model where it's more content planned, that doesn't necessarily feel the space for people to be open to their own change or adapting. But for me in this work, it's fundamental that we have A, self-awareness, and B, an open orientation toward change.
And recognizing, so the biggest the piece of research that I did recently was around integrity under pressure and how it can lead to hypocrisy. A lot of that came from my work of recognizing, if I'm going to stand and work with a group of people around resilience, for example, or power, or whatever it is, what is it that I'm, what's congruent with my work with others, and where is the incongruence, where actually I can look like a hypocrite? Because if I'm saying, you know, something around drinking lots of water, it's only when someone mentions the word water that I think, oh yeah, I probably should drink some water. You know, where am I being a hypocrite? Because if they're looking well, who are you then? Who are you to tell us if you're not even doing it? But I can share with them my struggle of how I struggle to do it, but recognizing why I'm doing it.
Yeah. And particularly important when we get into the more complex areas around things like power and inclusion, exclusion. You know, we're not untainted. We bring in a point of view, we bring in past experiences, and you know, we, whilst we might be able to share a model or share the theoretical academic background, anything that involves working live has to say, and I have some thoughts in this space, some proclivities, some biases possibly, and being aware of them. Mm-hmm. I often think, and it does sort of speak to, you know, whether we have supervision or whether we work in pairs, but there's something about, you know, how we stay aware enough in the live work, particularly in teams where, you know, it's, there's so much and so many sort of different aspects that are at play, that you can get lost in one and sort of be completely off the mark, which then doesn't serve the team.
Mm.
So just as part of a closing, what I'm inviting people to share is a micro practice that one of our listeners who may be a team leader or maybe a team member could take away and try or test out in their team.
Something I think is really important is understanding self. I think we've kind of talked about that already, but how do you understand yourself? How do you come to know what you know about yourself? And one of the things that I very often, if not always, build into programs that I'm working with leaders is something based on some research by Pine and Fletcher, and it's called Do Something Different. Their perspective is looking at behavior change. I'm extending it to look at behavior change and understanding values and beliefs, because I, through working with that, I discovered I was also finding out about my values and beliefs. And it's taking small things that, you know, there's no risk, there's no real risk involved, but it can feel risky. So it's an action, it's a doing something different that takes you away from your normal routine. Things like, one of the things I've often said is, you know, drive at exactly the speed limit. So just drive at exactly the speed limit, whatever, wherever you are. And you'll notice that...
So long as it's safe to do so.
Well, if you're driving at the speed limit, it should be safe to, well, yes, of course, if there's someone directly in front of you, yes, within reason, yes. I was like, yeah, of course. But you'll notice all sorts of things about the stories that are going on in your head, the narrative, the little voice that are going, oh god, this is so slow, like, really, is this meant to be the speed limit? Or, oh, this guy, look, I'm following the speed limit, why is he driving up behind me? You'll find out all the little narratives. Another one is write your eulogy. Back in the day when we could go for dinner by yourself, go for dinner by yourself, but without a book or a phone, just you in a restaurant.
Coming face to face with yourself.
And what do you do with your hands? How do you not listen to other people's conversations? How do you not find yourself just going at the next table? Just because that's the only thing... Fascinating, really so, fascinating.
So in the spirit of a team, is this something that you think that the team members could choose something that's relevant for them, you know, something that touches them and can take back to share within their team?
You could do it as a team, I was going to say challenge, but that makes it sound a bit kind of go, but you know, there's scope for us to go, well, what do we know about us, and let's do something different as a team. Let's, you know, where, you know, there's individual experiments, there's big team level experiments, there's all sorts of experiments, but ultimately it's the mindset to be experimental. That's what's the key of this, is that mindset to go, I'm going to do something different, I'm going to take the time to reflect, I'm going to think about the, so what does that mean? And I'm going to do something different again.
Yeah.
And developing that practice of that you are open to doing something. And then sometimes you'll find you're not. Sometimes you go, today I'm going to do it, and go, yeah. And then you find a reason not to do it.
Yeah.
Interesting data in itself.
Well, exactly. All good.
Story? What was the story I was telling myself about why not now? Why not today? Why this occasion versus another occasion? Because there'll always be an occasion. So what was the story? If no one, you know, of course, if no one's going to die, or, you know, there's the risks, there's no actual risks involved, only your ego, your potential kind of heart rate, yep, all of that stuff, all data. And I'm doing it quite, it's very interesting. You can do big ones or small ones, you know, take your pick.
Thank you.
But they don't have to be mind blowing. They just have to be.
I've got two final questions and then one final ask. So the two final questions are, what are you hopeful for as you look ahead? And how can we be more helpful in our teams?
What am I hopeful for? I am hopeful for some space opening up, I'll be honest. I've worked very hard to make this work for me, and I think I have. And going in the sort of commitment, you know, there's doing good stuff for the right reasons. I feel I've managed to do that. And I'm looking forward to things. I'm good with this, but I'm hopeful for us to be able to be more choiceful about where we're spending our time as much as we are with how we're spending our time. And what can we do to be more helpful? Well, actually, I'll offer back something that was really helpful for me from someone recently in my wider team, was the invitation to go for a walk and talk, but using our phones. And I know it's simple, we do it on programs and everything else, but I was so busy doing it, not doing it myself. And we agreed to have a conversation. Well, should we go out for a walk and talk? And it just reminded me of that physicality of walking and the connection that came from that. So yes, we were walking and talking, but the connections that came directly from that conversation, but also the connections that I made with the wider world. So keeping that in mind in terms of how are we connecting with each other? How are we relating to each other? That does require a bit of a spoke and wheel. So then there's still scope for how do we do that as a network of a team. But I think if we are paying attention to our relationships, I suppose it's a bit like if you look after the pennies, to some degree the pounds will look after themselves. You know, we have to look after every bit of it so that we can secure that big stuff.
It feels like it taps a bit back into your alignment line, which is it's not done in one big show. It's a series of small conversations regularly that lead up to, are we highly aligned or are we not?
Yeah. And hearing those small things about the difference, you know, like what the pressures that someone's under, or the, you know, the stuff that I can't base your life or my life because our lives are different. And my beliefs about life are going to be based on my experience.
Yeah.
So unless I actually have a conversation about the implications for you, I could let my beliefs of your life get in the way of believing based on mine.
Well, and I think that starting with recognizing that I'll have made assumptions because of who I am and the life I've led to date, I've lived to date. Even that, and saying, and you'll have had a different set of assumptions and a different life experience, that as a starting point is very different. And just allowing that difference and allowing and inviting, you know, so what are those assumptions? What is it that, you know, I might take for granted that I assume that you do, and then I realize we don't. So finally, Trudy, do you have a quote that galvanizes or inspires you, or a book that you consistently go back to? And I'm not really sort of thinking of an academic sort of business book necessarily, but what sort of inspires and lifts you?
There's a quote that I do tend to go back. I was just thinking, is it quite a long one? Is it too long? That's my inner critic going, me, me, me. But it's Viktor Frankl was a psychoanalyst who then went to become an Auschwitz victim. And he wrote Man's Search for Meaning. And he used his sort of practice to really kind of consider, how do people come about their knowing and their experience of being in prison, in encampment. And there was a quote that he uses, and it's, I'm probably going to get it wrong, but it's about between stimulus and response, there's a gap. And in that gap lies our choice. And in that choice lies our freedom. I know that's not exactly right, but that that moment to choose and recognizing you have a choice, I think is such a powerful thing. And that would be, that's the thing that I'm working on constantly, is that when I'm caught, actually, I have a choice. I have a choice to accept it or not accept it. I have a choice to say something, not say something, or whatever it might be. But that freedom is a big part of what I'm interested in, that liberty and freedom for people to live their life well.
Fabulous. Okay. Thank you so much. It's been... We've gone through the houses, I think, in terms of or around the houses. But I think it's been really helpful to hear your experiences of particularly this last 12 months and you know, what it's life's been like for leaders working in this digital, I've just come up with a new word. Is it digital or virtual space? So thank you so much, Trudy.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you for having me.
I hope you find our conversation as interesting as I did. I always learn a lot from Trudy, and I'm delighted to speak with her at such an important time for leaders and teams. It's always nourishing and thought-provoking. So my thanks again to Trudy for joining me today. Another step towards supporting teams become more human and more impactful. Details of how to get in touch with Trudy and any references we've made in this episode will be on the website www.debbiewaith.com under episode information. And of course, how did you get on with the questions you asked yourself? What have you learned of yourself over this past year? And what could you experiment with? How are your relationships? And where might you need to spend time renewing or repairing? And how can you recreate that transitional space for a different quality of thinking and the new ways of working? I hope we've given you some food for thought, and would love to hear any feedback that you have. You can get in touch with me on my website, www.debbiewaith.com. I'll be releasing a new Team Time Table Talks every Tuesday. We'd love for these to be accessed by all those who you think would be interested, by sharing on your favourite platform. And remember to subscribe to not miss the latest episode. Thanks for listening, and I wish you a hopeful and helpful week ahead. Goodbye.
Subscribe to Team Time.